Good day. Welcome to another episode of the Audible Local Ledger Reads to the Blind podcast. You can get more information at audiblelocalledger.org. Stay tuned for today's reading.
Hi, I'm Beth, and I'll be reading you today's e-edition of the Cape Cod Times, dated Monday, March 11th. We start with weather in the lottery. Well, after yesterday's warmth, it's kind of a quick change back to coolish temperatures today with a high of only 44 and quite windy, some clouds and some sun mixed in. Tomorrow, though, things warm up. It's a high of 54. There should be plenty of sunshine. Wednesday drops down a bit, a high of 47. But then you get to Thursday, it's 54 degrees high again, times of sun and clouds, a chance of some light rain showers. Taking a look at the lottery for the weekend, the numbers game midday drawing for Sunday, March 10th was 8223. Last night's drawing of the numbers game, 7647. Mass cash for Sunday, 2, 7, 10, 15, 19. And the Powerball number for Saturday, March 9th, 30, 36, 49, 52, 63, Powerball, 16. First front page headline, the DPW did not want to proceed. With the Park City Wind Project delayed, Barnstable is going to Plan B with its Centerville sewering schedule, a plan originally tied in with the anticipated start of onshore construction for the 804-megawatt wind project. The town council on Thursday approved borrowing $30.9 million to fund sewer infrastructure improvements that will now begin farther inland instead of at Craigville Beach. The DPW did not want to proceed with our sewer expansion project in Centerville Village, which would result in a multiple construction efforts when eventually a Park City Wind project entered the construction phase, said Barnstable DPW Director Daniel Santos, who talked about the new schedule at the council meeting. The DPW has developed a hybrid project it is calling the Centerville Village Sewer Expansion North Phase, expected to begin in the fall. The work will include installing new sewers on Route 28 from Finney's Lane to Old Stage Road, Old Stage Road from Route 28 to Chute Flying Hill Road, Chute Flying Hill Road from Old Stage Road to the Service Road, and Finney's Lane from Route 28 to Main Street. Three new pump stations are also planned, two on Chute Flying Hill and one at Mother's Park. Now, the original plan was to start the Centerville Village sewer expansion project at Craigville Beach in tandem with the proposed Park City Wind Power Cable Duct Bank route. The project was approved in 2023 by the State Revolving Fund Loan Program, with plans to begin in the fall of 2024, and included an associated 25% subsidy from the Cape and Islands Water Protection Fund. Design funds were secured for the Route 28 West Sewer Expansion Project, which will install the backbone of the sewer project, heading west from Finney's Lane to Route 149, Santos said. Construction is expected to start in the fall of 2025. Because of national and global economic events, Avangrid last year said its offshore wind projects, including a proposal to land power cables in Barnstable, Park City Wind, and Commonwealth Wind, were no longer financially viable. Avangrid backed out of power purchase agreements it had with utilities in Connecticut and Massachusetts in hopes of winning new contracts under better terms in upcoming wind procurement solicitations. Since then, Massachusetts has opened its fourth and largest wind procurement round, which will select bids for projects totaling up to 3,600 megawatts. Proposals were initially due at the end of January, but that deadline was extended to the end of March. In October, Governor Maura Healey announced a first-of-its-kind agreement between Massachusetts, Rhode Island, and Connecticut, a partnership that invites developers to submit multi-state offshore wind proposals totaling up to 6,000 megawatts, which can be considered through each state's offshore wind procurements this year. Santos said the DPW still wants to work in tandem with the Park City Wind Project northward from Craigville Beach should the project gain a new power purchase agreement and final permits. Installing the cable ducts at the same time as the sewer lines will minimize construction impacts and result in savings in road construction and paving costs, he said. The DPW will continue to design the Centerville Village Sewer Expansion South Phase and bring that forward for construction funding when there is more certainty around the Park City Wind Project schedule, Santos said. Starting the sewer work farther inland allows a window for Avangrid to catch up with the town if it gets the okay to proceed. Because that's a difficult area for construction, it's going to take probably 2 years just to put the sewers and shoot Flying Hill Road, Santos told the council. So it's good for us to get a head start. The offshore cabling doesn't take as long because it's a different process, working at different depths, he said. They actually move very quickly. Ideally, if the offshore project progresses, it will come up right behind us, and we can get away with a base coat or a temporary finish, Santos said, but if it's going to be a while, we may have to put a more permanent pavement surface. The town will borrow from the State Revolving Loan Fund under an anticipated low financing rate to pay for the Centerville project, and will also have that anticipated 25% principal subsidy from the Cape and Islands Water Protection Fund. The estimated annual loan payment is approximately $1 million for 30 years, Santos said. Loan payments will be included in future annual operating budgets. The revenue source for this will be dedicated funds within the Sewer Construction and Private Way Improvement Fund. Director of Finance Mark Milne said local meal and room taxes on traditional lodging are credited to this dedicated fund for sewer construction and improvements to certain eligible private ways. These funds are then used used to pay the annual debt service on loans taken out to finance the sewer construction, including the loan we will issue to finance the construction of the Centerville Village Sewer Expansion Plan, he said in an email on Friday. Additionally, Milne said the town is dedicating other resources to the anticipated loans it will issue for other future sewer projects. These include a local room tax on short-term rentals and up to $5,750,000 annually in property taxes. The town has also established the Sewer Assessment Ordinance, which currently caps sewer assessments at $10,000 per dwelling unit, he said. Revenue collected from assessments will also be used to pay back the loans taken out to finance sewer construction. We have yet to see any revenue from sewer assessments, as the Strawberry Hill Road Sewer Expansion Project will be the first project eligible to connect later this year. Second front page headline, the new Provincetown Police Station to open soon. It's almost moving day for the P-Town Police Department. A new police station at 2 Jerome Smith Road is set to become operational on April 4th. It's a big step up from the department's current headquarters, a former funeral home that has long been deemed inadequate as a public facility, according to information provided by Provincetown Assistant Town Manager Dan Riviello. The new station is a remarkable improvement from the old one, said Provincetown Select Board member Leslie Sandberg. Shortcomings of the current station, which has been in use since 1986, include occasional flooding, building code violations, and problems with accommodating modern communication equipment, according to the town. A total of $17 million was approved by town meeting voters for the new 13,900-square-foot facility next to Route 6. It is a huge accomplishment, wrote Provincetown Police Chief Jim Golden in an email to the Times. Provincetown now has a police facility whose quality matches the professionals for whom it was built. According to the town, the new police station features state-of-the-art heating, cooling, and lighting systems. The building is also solar-ready, and town staff will work with the Cape and Vineyard Electrical Cooperative to install a solar array at no cost. The public is invited to a ribbon-cutting ceremony for the new facility, slated for noon on March 20th. Town officials will give brief remarks, followed by guided tours of the station. In this story, a Hyannis man was arraigned Thursday and ordered held without bail on charges brought in connection with the Thanksgiving Day shooting in Hyannis in 2023. Mark Griswold, 53, was arraigned in Barnstable Superior Court on a number of charges, including armed assault with intent to murder, assault and battery with a dangerous weapon, assault and battery on a family household member, and intimidation of witness, according to the Office of Cape and Islands District Attorney Robert Galibois. The charges stem from a November 23, 2023 incident in which gunshots were fired and a person was hit. Police went to a Hyannis address after receiving a 911 call at 5:37 p.m. After an investigation that included video canvassing and ballistic tests, detectives determined that Griswold was the shooter. The case will be prosecuted by Assistant DA Alexandra Isaacs. Griswold had recently been released from state prison for gun-related offenses, according to the DA's statement. Griswold is scheduled for a hearing on March 15th in Barnstable Superior Court to determine if he is a danger to the public and should be held without bail until the case is resolved. He is being held at the Barnstable House of Correction. On April 9th, Griswold will appear in Superior Court for a probation surrender hearing related to gun possession charges. Danielle Whitney with the DA's office declined to comment further on the case. Attorney Kyle Wibby is representing Griswold. He wasn't available for comment on Friday afternoon. And here is this week's photo column written by Cape Cod Times chief photographer Steve Heeslip, titled "An Opportunity for Close-Up of Vineyard Wind Assembly in New Bedford." Always take advantage of the offer for a boat trip or a plane ride. This sage advice was given to me long ago by then Cape Cod Times chief photographer Gordon Caldwell. Back in the day before cell phones and Google Maps, a payphone call to the photo desk, 775-1200 extension 165, was almost always answered by him. He was an almanac on all things Cape Cod, giving directions to a spot news location and even the fire chief's name to find when you arrived. A well-placed call from him to his connections could get a staff photographer on a boat, a plane charter, or even a ride on a Coast Guard helicopter. Much has changed since the days when the tiny cubicle with a light table was the hub for all things photo at 319 Main Street. Photos now are sent to a Gannett computer server, many shipped on scene remotely via laptop and a Wi-Fi hotspot. But when it comes to making interesting photographs, getting out on the water or up in the air is still a great way for a different perspective on even routine assignments. So when Mass Maritime Academy offered a harbor tour of New Bedford and an opportunity for a close waterside look at Vineyard Wind's shoreside staging area, it was a quick yes. The trip was part of the annual Woman on the Water conference held at the school. Our boat for the excursion was the Cutty Hunk Ferry, captained by Jono Billings. No telephoto lens required for this look at wind farm equipment. He brought us up alongside a specially constructed barge that cradled three turbine blades. The 321-foot-long blades stretched out along the pier, pulled everyone to one side of the ferry as we all jockeyed for a photo angle. Tower sections placed vertically, ready for transport out to the offshore site south of Martha's Vineyard, gave the impression of a small city rising. Arriving back at the dock, the rain was holding off, but skies were growing angry. I raced along the waterfront to a parking area on Gifford Street, along the hurricane barrier and a front row view of the wind facility. I had water view images, but needed an aerial to complete the photo gallery. The near-empty lot was a perfect drone launch pad. It was a 2-minute flight, up 200 feet, then quickly down as the rain came on strong. But just enough time for a photo to show the scale of the operation. Photos from sea air, and land, the photo mission was complete, all in a day's work. And again, that was written by Cape Cod Chief Photographer Steve Heeslip, Cape Cod Times Chief Photographer. This headline, school budgets and masks can't keep up with inflation, advocates say. School districts across the state are facing a fiscal cliff that could result in staff and service cuts. That's according to education advocacy groups that are calling on lawmakers to rethink school funding approaches. In her fiscal 2025 budget, Governor Maura Healey calls for a 4% increase to public education aid, called Chapter 70 funding, from $6.5 billion to $6.85 billion. This proposed $263 million increase for K-12 schools would follow a $594 million, or 9.9% increase in Chapter 70 funding in fiscal 2024 budget. Despite these injections of aid, school budgets haven't been able to keep up with inflation, the Mass Association of School Superintendents and Mass Association of School Committees told lawmakers at a recent hearing. In addition, they say rural schools have taken a hit as declining enrollments have left their coffers dry under the current school funding formulas, and the $1.5 billion Student Opportunity Act, meant to close education funding gaps, is mostly focused on plugging holes in urban districts. The school groups are making their case to House Democrats, who plan in April to unveil their rewrite of Healey's spending bill. We are hearing widespread reports that our districts are describing a cliff effect in the decline of budget revenue, largely due to inflation rates calculated over the past 3 years, which will result in significant reductions in programs and services for our students this year, said Mary Bork, co-executive director of the Mass Association of School Superintendents. Bork said school costs have increased dramatically over the last few years due to high inflation rates, affecting everything from special ed and transportation to building maintenance, curriculum costs, and cost of living increases for staff. While inflation was at 7% in 2023 and 8% in fiscal 2024, the foundation budget for schools was increased by only 4.5%. With the national inflation rate closer to 3%, the application of the lower inflation rate leaves many districts desperately short of real cost increases, including negotiated personnel costs. The superintendent and school committee groups and the two largest teacher unions in the state, the Mass Teachers Association and the state branch of the American Federation of Teachers, all backed a request for lawmakers to fix a flaw in how the Chapter 70 formula treatment of inflation that is causing a steep funding cliff in our school districts. The way that Chapter 70 originally worked, the value lost to inflation in those years would have been made up in future years. But because of a glitch that was an unintended consequence of a change in the formula, value lost to the cap in 1 year is no longer made up in future years. And this is having serious consequences in our schools. We need to fix this, Bork said. The school-based group suggests adding an additional 2.58% inflation in fiscal 2025 to make up for value lost in 23 and to change the law so that the value lost this year will be made up for in future years. Asked by Representative Andy Vargas how much increasing the inflation rate to their suggested amount would cost, Bork replied, "We do admit it's somewhere around $400 million. At the March 1st public hearing in Greenfield, advocates also raised concerns about how Chapter 70 counts low-income students and directs more funding to districts that serve greater low-income populations, as the end of the pandemic emergency has shifted who qualifies for certain income-eligible programs. Healey's budget reinstates a stricter definition of low income, restricting the label to families below 185% of the federal poverty level, and replacing the economically disadvantaged designation based on 133% of the federal poverty level used from 2017 through 2022. The Chapter 70 funding formula directs money towards districts with higher percentages of low-income students who may need more resources and support. Additionally, the formula determines a district's low-income enrollment based on how many students participate in state public assistance programs, including Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, which is SNAP, Traditional Aid to Families with Dependent Children, MassHealth, and Foster Care. These programs, however, have seen significant declines in enrollment over the past year as pandemic-era freezes on program eligibility have expired. Massachusetts is now almost finished with its campaign to determine how many of the 2.4 million people on MassHealth rolls last April still qualify for the publicly funded health insurance. The federal government prohibited people from losing Medicaid coverage during the pandemic. That policy has ended, requiring all 50 states to embark on similarly gargantuan reviews. Since the number of students on MassHealth is one of the Chapter 70 determinants, education advocates argued that some districts where students are getting redetermined off of the public health insurance are also losing school funding. Over 6,000 students have fallen off the low-income count in 1 year. That argues to me that it is not that we actually have that many fewer students who are low-income, but that something has gone wrong with the count, said Tracy Novick, a field director for the Mass Association of School Committees. In Pittsfield, two students changed income classification this year, and there was a $1 million impact to the district's foundation budget. Are you suggesting that if they lost it because the family income is above the threshold, are you saying they should still be counted as a low-income student, even if their family's income is actually above the threshold defined for low-income students? Asked Senator Jason Lewis, who is the chair of the Joint Committee on Education. Families are hesitant to share their financial income and self-identity as low-income. Something that districts have long found, and I suspect that we perhaps are seeing now, is whether or not families are willing to actually put forward any kind of information in order to get themselves certified. Education Secretary Patrick Tutwiler, representing Healey's administration, said the governor's proposal would prioritize these lower-income cities, but that does not exclude other communities from applying. And to some political news, in the wake of the Supreme Court's decision to hear former President Donald Trump's presidential immunity appeal in late April, legal experts disagree on whether the scheduling is a gift for the Republican frontrunner and whether it signals the justices may be sympathetic to his argument or desired timeline. Scheduling oral arguments for 2 months after that decision is faster than the court's typical timeline for hearing cases. It leaves open the possibility of a trial in Trump's federal election interference case before the election. Still, liberal critics who noted the court has moved more quickly in urgent cases lambasted the schedule for potentially delaying a trial or verdict until after the November election. Many fear Trump will take the unprecedented step of ordering the Justice Department to drop the criminal case if he becomes president next year. They've created a schedule that I think is going to make things very, very difficult, and so I think the idea that the Supreme Court is going to be some sort of salvation here is not a sound one. We don't have any reason to believe that, said Sherilyn Ifill, the former head of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. Trump's federal election interference case in Washington, from which the Supreme Court appeal arose, is on hold. He faces charges of conspiring to defraud the country and obstruct the presidential election certification process in order to overturn his 2020 defeat. District Judge Tanya Chutkan initially scheduled the trial to start March 4th, but agreed with Trump that many pretrial proceedings needed to be paused as he appealed over the presidential immunity issue. Trump's legal team has argued that the targeted actions in the indictment fell within the scope of his presidential duties, and he is therefore absolutely immune from prosecution. That stance was rejected by Chutkan and later unanimously by a 3-judge panel of the Federal Appeals Court. Special Prosecutor Jack Smith has argued that legal principles and historical evidence show former presidents are subject to federal criminal prosecution like other citizens. And even if there were permanent criminal immunity for presidential actions, the case would survive because that immunity wouldn't encompass every allegation in the indictment. Chutkin tossed out the March 4th date as the immunity appeal dragged on. Anticipating exactly this potential time crunch, Smith asked the Supreme Court to leapfrog an appeals court and take the case on December 12, 2023. The justices declined. After Trump lost at the appeals court and asked the high court to keep the case on hold on February 12th, pending his expected appeal to the Supreme Court, the justices could have refused his request and ultimately let the appeals court ruling stand. As several days went by without the high court taking the case and scheduling arguments, some observers thought the justices might be preparing to do just that, especially since Trump had argued for extremely expansive immunity. A president who ordered a political opponent's assassination could not be prosecuted, Trump's lawyers told the appeals court, unless he is first impeached and removed from office. The appeals court had already issued a lengthy ruling denouncing his claim that, quote, a president has unbounded authority to commit crimes that would neutralize the most fundamental check on executive power, the recognition and implementation of election results, end quote. Instead, the justices waited 2 weeks, granted Trump's request, decided to review the case, and then set a schedule that pushed oral arguments out about 2 more months to the week of April 22nd. The court has since settled on April 25th as the exact date. It takes 4 justices to decide to hear a case, and typically 5 to place or keep proceedings at a lower court on hold. If the justices wanted to weigh in, why didn't they just take the case back when Smith asked them to? The most plausible explanation, some say, is to help Trump, and that implies they will be on his side through the rest of the case. When the justices take about 2 weeks to issue this order, and then they come back and they say we're going to get these arguments in 7 weeks, they're going up to that calendar and they are putting 9 weeks of days and they are burning them for Donald Trump, and MSNBC host Chris Hayes said. If they want to move fast after April 22nd, and they want to issue that opinion, they can, Hayes said. Do I think they will after what they signaled today? Not likely. The Supreme Court is capable of moving faster in the case than it has chosen to thus far. In Bush versus Gore, the case that suspended a Florida recount and effectively declared George W. Bush the 2000 presidential winner, the court accepted, heard, and decided the case in under a week. In Trump versus Anderson, in which the justices kept Trump on the Colorado ballot Monday, they accepted the case in 2 days, scheduled arguments for less than 5 weeks later, and issued an opinion within a month from there in advance of the Super Tuesday presidential primaries. Still, under normal procedures, the justices could have waited much longer simply to schedule arguments and then held those arguments in the fall. The briefs are due very soon. The orals are in April. That's actually a pretty expedited review at this point, said David Schultz, a visiting law professor at the University of Minnesota, who teaches about elections and constitutional law. I know some people are saying, oh, the court's delaying on this. No, I think they're actually moving pretty quickly on this one, Schultz told USA Today. Andy Gruhl, a law professor at the University of Iowa, argued that the high court's schedule is lightning fast for a question that involves not just Trump, but the entire institution of the presidency. The normal procedure for this type of question, he said, would be to schedule arguments for October and then sit on the case for months while trading drafts before issuing a decision. If it wasn't for this election, there's no way the Supreme Court would rush such a monumental decision, Gruhl said. Michael McConnell, a Stanford law professor and former federal judge, pointed to the Supreme Court's framing of the issue it will address as a signal of how it may rule. In its February 28th order agreeing to hear the case, the court said it will review whether, and if so, to what extent does a former president enjoy presidential immunity from criminal prosecution for conduct alleged to involve official acts during his tenure in office. The court's language departed significantly from proposals both Smith and Trump made in December for what the justices should address. They asked the court to weigh in on absolute immunity for a former president or for a president's official acts, as well as on how congressional impeachment proceedings could impact potential presidential immunity. The Supreme Court, by contrast, didn't explicitly raise the idea of absolute immunity at all, and its "if so, to what extent" phrasing might indicate an interest in applying immunity to some actions but not others. Schultz said the High Court could issue a ruling that calls for distinguishing between allegations that are and are not protected by presidential immunity, but then leave it for a jury to apply that distinction at trial. So we've reached the halfway point of our broadcast, and at this point we read today's obituaries. Agnes Patty Jackson died peacefully at the age of 106 at her home of 82 years in Watertown on March 1st. Born in Boston, she became a registered nurse at the New England Hospital for Women and Children, which was established to train female doctors and where the first registered nurse graduated. Her last nursing position was public health nurse for the town of Watertown. She was a strong, independent, joyful woman who loved to travel the world, tell jokes, and play cards. She was a huge proponent of higher education, women's rights, and democratic values. She's predeceased by her siblings, the pugilistic Rogans of Roxbury. Mary, Paul, Bess McDermott, John Rogan, Alice Bean, Cecilia Cahill, and Sherman Rogan. She married the love of her life, Norman Jackson, at 25, moved to Watertown, and raised four children, summering in Rye, New Hampshire, and in Dennis. Unfortunately, Norman died suddenly when she was only 54. She continued her life with joy and strength by embracing her family and friends. They had four children, Patty and Bob Cicchetti, Tony and Kathy Jackson, Kristen Mead, and Regina and Fred Hajar. In addition, she had 11 grandchildren and 16 loving great-grandchildren. At the urging of doctors who marveled at her incredible health and mind until the very end, her body was donated to Harvard Medical School. A funeral mass will be held at St. Patrick's Church on Main Street in Watertown at 11 a.m. on March 16th, which would have been her 107th birthday. James Luther Connor, 88, passed away peacefully on February 20th after a lengthy illness, with his wife Sylvia by his side. After graduating high school, Jim enlisted in the Army and served his country in both the Texas Army National Guard and on active duty in the Signal Corps from 1954 through 58. While on active duty, Jim was stationed in New York and completed an overseas service tour in Taiwan as a sergeant. Jim studied at SUNY New Paltz, earning a bachelor's degree, and taught in New York public schools. Jim met Sylvia when they were teaching at Waterford Public Schools. After they married, he studied art history at Penn State, sculpture at the University of Utah, and was granted a sabbatical from Britton Kill New York Public Schools to research the Roman influence on church architecture in southern France. Jim is survived by his wife of 61 years, Sylvia Connor, and his brother Thomas of Troy, New York. He was predeceased in 2017 by his son Alex, who remembered his year in France as one of the happiest in his life. The family would like to thank the Sandwich EMTs for their many acts of kindness and the wonderful caregivers from TLC, Private Home Care Services, and the McCarthy Hospice Care Center. A celebration of life service will be held on April 13th at 11 a.m. at St. John's Episcopal Church, 159 Main Street in Sandwich. And John Jack Christopher Martin, 87, passed away peacefully Thursday night, February 29th, after a lengthy illness. He was born in New Britain, Connecticut. It was here in Springfield where he met and married his wife of 62 years, Ruth Martin. Mr. Jack is best known to the community for the time he spent working for the town of Chatham as the gate attendant at the transfer station. Everyone was a friend to him. He treated all he met with kindness, generosity, humor, and respect, and he always had a treat for the pups that visited. When not making friends with his canine visitors, Mr. Jack liked to relax by reading, listening to jazz, and watching the Red Sox. Jack is survived by his wife, Ruth, his four sons, John, Patrick, Timothy, and Brendan, his daughter-in-law, Jean, and his three granddaughters. Visitation will be held at Nickerson Funeral Home, 87 Kroll Road in Chatham, on Sunday, March 17th, from noon to 4. A Masonic service held by St. Martin's Lodge will be held at 1 p.m. Lodge will be open at 12:30 p.m. at Nickerson Funeral Home, Chatham. Back to the news. Fresh off a fiery State of the Union address where he targeted his likely opponent by everything but name, President Joe Biden is in campaign mode. The president has embarked on a tour of battleground states that began with Pennsylvania on Friday and Georgia over the weekend. His reelection campaign is launching a six-week, $30 million ad buy, opening more than 100 offices across the country and hiring more than 350 new staff members. He'll campaign for the first time this cycle in New Hampshire on Monday and visit the critical swing states of Wisconsin and Michigan on Wednesday and Thursday. Biden's blitz follows former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley's exit from the GOP race after a string of losses in Super Tuesday primaries. The president's campaign said it raised $1.5 million in the 24 hours after Super Tuesday's primary, which also forced out Biden's top challenger for the Democratic nomination, retiring Representative Dean Phillips of Minnesota. Thursday was the best fundraising day for Biden's campaign since he announced his reelection bid. Biden on Thursday came out swinging against Trump in the House chamber. He started and ended the annual primetime address with references to his predecessor as he began a campaign to bring home wayward Democrats and reel in Trump-averse Republicans. In some medical news, more than a half a dozen large private health insurance companies have agreed to cover the cost of navigators, people who guide cancer patients and their families through the confusing array of medical appointments and drug treatments that follow a diagnosis. The expansion of the Cancer Navigator Program, part of President Joe Biden's ambitious Cancer Moonshot, is among a handful of health initiatives unveiled last week to coincide with the President's State of the Union address. Advocates say navigators help guide patients and their families through medical appointments and choices they face after a cancer diagnosis. Administration officials cited research that found navigators help reduce wait times between diagnosis and treatment. Patients are also more likely to complete treatment when they work with a navigator. Beginning this year, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services announced it would cover navigation services for older Americans on Medicare. The agency also established billing codes for hospitals and doctors to bill health insurance companies for navigator services. The Biden administration announced that seven large private health insurance companies have agreed to cover navigator services: Aetna, Blue Cross Blue Shield of Minnesota, Elevance Health, Health Alliance Plan, Humana, Priority Health, and Select Health. In addition, 40 cancer care centers and clinics will extend navigator services to patients. The list includes high-profile cancer care centers such as Dana-Farber in Boston, the Duke Cancer Institute, Northwell Health, and the Mayo Clinic. This is about making sure that a growing number of Americans can get access as they need it, Aradi Prabhkar, director of the White House Office of Science and Technology, told USA Today. The companies that have signed up to provide insurance coverage for these services reach 150 million Americans. Patient advocates who are familiar with the difficulties of managing a cancer diagnosis in the nation's fragmented healthcare system said navigators play a critical role. Kathy Giusti, a two-time cancer survivor and co-founder of the Multiple Myeloma Research Foundation, often talks about the challenges patients face after a cancer diagnosis. She described the U.S. healthcare system as vast, fragmented, and challenging, and worries patients are missing out on the best treatments science is delivering. She said Medicare's coverage of navigators and the broader rollout with the private insurers will help patients. Trained navigators will ease the burden placed on patients and their caregivers, said Giusti, whose book, Fatal to Fearless, 12 Steps to Beating Cancer in a Broken Medical System, describes her cancer journey and provides tips for others. This is a positive short-term solution to a much longer-term problem. Navigators can educate patients on how to advocate for and better coordinate care. Specially trained individuals also can connect patients and their families to social services to address food and housing needs and transportation. And here's today's Ask Carolyn column with the headline, Boyfriend Always Forecasts a Breakup After Arguments. Dear Carolyn, when my boyfriend and I get into arguments, he inevitably says, maybe we shouldn't be together, or there are obviously compatibility issues. Our relationship is complicated by the fact that he is in the process of getting a divorce, which has recently become more dramatic and has led to more stress on us. I'm hurt by his comments and increasingly becoming insecure in the relationship. Can you provide any insight? If it helps, I love yous have been exchanged as we've discussed our future together. Signed, S. Dear S, I know your if it helps is about helping me answer your question. However, that talk of love and future strikes me as being particularly unhelpful to you. That's because when you and he gaze into each other's eyes and see white picket fences, it's natural for you to start mentally writing a fairy tale about the two of you. Then when he says things like, maybe we shouldn't be together, or you're not thinking, maybe not, or was this fight worth fighting, or was I being fair and was he? Instead, your mind jumps right to that fairy tale, and your primary focus becomes save that picket fence. I feel no particular resentment toward the princess myths of my childhood, I swear, but dreams are vastly overrated. Ideas, great. Plans, necessary. Inspiration, bring it on. Imagination, sure, as long as you know you're just making up stuff, and reality will eventually have its say. But dreams, I don't know. They seem to get cultural carte blanche when in many cases they're just imaginings unmoored from reality. Exhibit A, the bridal industry complex. You, S, are probably feeling insecure because you're harboring dreams of where you want this relationship to go when in fact there's a whole lot of reality clearing its throat to be heard. You're hoping, he's doubting. You're both fighting, his divorce is escalating. Please just wipe out whatever you've imagined happening and force yourself to think clearly about what is happening. Specifically, do you get along in most cases without much effort? Do you like him as is? If you weren't physically attracted to each other, would you choose each other as friends? Do you talk easily? Do you seek each other out equally? Can you hit your normal highs and lows without fear of scaring him off? And no sanity list is complete without these. Are you strong enough to say out loud to him, if you don't think we should be together, then why don't you just break up with me? Not soap opera, just matter of fact. And if this relationship ends, can you envision yourself crying it out and then carrying on? The first set of questions is about the way you get along with him. The second is about the way you get along with you. Unless you get yeses on both sides, the white picket fence is a trap. Meanwhile, those raw feelings in his ongoing divorce are already telling you to slow down, calm down, pace yourself, and think. Now I'm saying it too. Here's a headline, Microplastics in Blood Boost Heart Disease Risk. Microplastics are everywhere, even in plaque, the fatty deposits that can build up in the arteries and cause heart disease and strokes. Now researchers in Italy have found that people with microplastics in their plaque are 4.5 times more likely to be at risk of heart attack, stroke, or death than those whose plaque didn't contain microplastics, said Dr. Eric Topol, a cardiologist and executive vice president of Scripps Research in La Jolla, California. It's extraordinary, he said. I'm a cardiologist for 3 decades plus, and I never envisioned we'd have microplastics in our arteries, and its presence would accelerate arteriosclerosis. The study was published in this week's edition of the New England Journal of Medicine. While it was able to link the presence of microplastics to health effects, it does not prove that microplastics cause the increase in deaths in heart disease, as there could be other variables at play. Blockage of the arteries, especially the carotid arteries in the neck, is a well-known danger sign for stroke and heart disease. When the neck arteries become blocked or congested with the plaque, less blood flows to the brain, sometimes resulting in stroke or even death. One treatment is to surgically remove the plugs of plaque. Many studies have shown that tiny bits of plastic, some too small to be seen, can enter the human body through food, inhalation, or exposure to the skin, and have been found in the placenta, lungs, liver, breast milk, urine, and blood. To find out if there were microplastics in the fatty deposits, the Italian researchers tested for microplastic in the plaque that had been removed from the necks of 257 patients between 2019 and 2020. Of those 150, 58% had measurable amounts of polyethylene and sometimes polyvinyl chloride. Using chemical tests and electron microscopes, the researchers also found visible jagged-edge foreign particles in the fatty deposits. Previous studies have shown that microplastic and nanoplastic particles can induce inflammation and other negative effects in the body. The Italian researchers tested for inflammatory markers and found more of them in the blood of patients with higher levels of microplastics. After studying the patients for 34 months, the rate of a heart attack, stroke, and death was 4.5 times higher in people with microplastics and inflammatory markers than those without. Dr. Philip Landrigan, who wrote an editorial that appeared with the study, described the research as a call to arms. "Inaction is no longer an option," wrote Landrigan, who directs the Program for Global Public Health and the Common Good at Boston College. What can physicians and other health professionals do? The first step is to recognize that the low cost and convenience of plastics are deceptive and that, in fact, they mask great harms. We need to encourage our patients to reduce their use of plastics, especially unnecessary single-use items. In this headline, CDC says kids end up in ER after taking melatonin. Nearly 11,000 U.S. children recently visited an ER after ingesting melatonin they took without supervision, according to a new federal report. Building on prior research, the report notes a 420% increase in children taking the sleep-inducing supplement and landing in ERs in the past 10 years. Melatonin is a hormone the brain produces in response to darkness. It is an increasingly popular adult supplement sold as tablets or gummies that people take to help with sleep. The report issued Thursday by the CDC found a startling increase in babies and children consuming the supplement, often leading to calls to poison centers and emergency visits. The high number of unsupervised melatonin ingestions highlights the continued need to educate parents and other caregivers about the importance of keeping all medications and supplements, including gummies, out of children's reach and sight, the report said. Researchers estimated that babies and children made almost 11,000 emergency room visits between 2019 and 2022 after ingesting melatonin when their parents weren't watching. Federal regulations do not require child-resistant packaging for supplements like melatonin, which don't face the same level of scrutiny as prescription meds, CDC researchers said. And users don't necessarily know what they're buying. A 2023 Journal of the American Medical Association study found most melatonin gummies are not accurately labeled. About a third of infants and children in the data had accessed melatonin from a bottle, which the research suggests had not been properly closed. The 420% increase in ER visits was determined based on data from 2009 and 2020, CDC people said. A prior CDC report found a 530% increase in calls to poison centers for pediatric melatonin ingestion. The National Center for Complementary and Integrative Health said parents should consult a health care provider before giving melatonin to children. And this headline, Oscars go nuclear with Oppenheimer winning big. Oppenheimer, a solemn three-hour biopic that became an unlikely billion-dollar box office sensation, was crowned Best Picture at a 96th Academy Awards that doubled as a coronation for director Christopher Nolan. After passing over arguably Hollywood's foremost big-screen director for years, the Oscars made up for lost time by heaping seven awards on Nolan's blockbuster biopic, including Best Actor for Cillian Murphy, Best Supporting Actor for Robert Downey Jr., and Best Director for Nolan. In anointing Oppenheimer, the Academy of Motion Picture Arts did something it hasn't done for more than a decade, hand its top prize to a widely seen, big-budget studio film. In a film industry where a cape, a dinosaur, or Tom Cruise has often been a requirement for such box office, Oppenheimer brought droves of moviegoers to theaters with a complex, fission-filled drama about J. Robert Oppenheimer and the creation of the atomic bomb. For better or worse, we're all living in Robert Oppenheimer's world, said Murphy in his acceptance speech. I'd like to dedicate this to the peacemakers. As a film heavy with unease for human capacity for mass destruction, Oppenheimer also emerged, even over its partner in cultural phenomenon, Barbie, as a fittingly foreboding film for times rife with cataclysm, man-made or not. Sunday's Oscars at the Dolby Theater in L.A. unfolded against the backdrop of wars in Gaza and Ukraine and with a potentially momentous U.S. election on the horizon. The most closely watched contest of the Academy Awards went to Emma Stone, who won Best Actress for her performance as Bella Baxter in Poor Things. In what was seen as the night's most nail-biting category, Stone won over Lily Gladstone of Killers of the Flower Moon. Gladstone would have become the first Native American to win an Academy Award. Instead, Oscar voters couldn't resist the full-bodied extremes of Stone's Poor Things performance. The win for Stone, her second Best Actress Oscar, following her 2019 win for La La Land, confirmed the 35-year-old is arguably the preeminent big-screen actress of her generation. The list of women to win Best Actress two or more times is illustrious, including Katharine Hepburn, Frances McDormand, and Betty Davis. Oh boy, this is really overwhelming, Stone said. Nolan has had many movies in the Oscar mix before, including Inception, Dunkirk, and The Dark Knight, but his win Sunday for direction is the first Academy Award for the 53-year-old filmmaker. In his acceptance speech, Nolan noted cinema is just over 100 years old. We don't know where this incredible journey is going from here, said Nolan, but to think that I'm a meaningful part of it means the world to me. Protest and politics intruded on an election year Academy Awards on Sunday, where demonstrations for Gaza raged outside the Dolby Theater, and awards went to Oppenheimer, The Zone of Interest, and 20 Days in Mariupol. Sunday's broadcast, hosted by Jimmy Kimmel, had plenty of razzle-dazzle, including a sprawling song and dance rendition of the Barbie hit I'm Just Ken by Ryan Gosling with an assist on guitar by Slash. A sea of Kens swarmed the stage. The lead winner, as expected, was Oppenheimer, the blockbuster biopic. Though not quite the clean sweep that some expected, Oppenheimer was overpowering all competition, including its release date companion, Barbie, winning awards for its cinematography, editing, score, and Robert Downey Jr.'s supporting performance. Barbie, last year's biggest box office hit with more than $1.4 billion in ticket sales, didn't win an award until almost 3 hours into the ceremony, and it won for Best Song for Billie Eilish and Phineas's What Was I Made Of? It's their second Oscar, 2 years after winning for their James Bond theme, No Time to Die. But after an award season that stayed largely inside a Hollywood bubble, geopolitics played a prominent role. Protest over Israel's war in Gaza snarled traffic around the theater, slowing stars' arrival on the red carpet and turning the Oscar spotlight toward the ongoing conflict. Some protesters shouted shame at those trying to reach the awards. Jonathan Glazer, the British filmmaker whose chilling Auschwitz drama, The Zone of Interest, won Best International Film, drew connections between the dehumanization depicted in his film and today. Right now, we stand here as men who refute their Jewishness and the Holocaust being hijacked by an occupation which has led to conflict for so many innocent people, whether the victims of October the 7th in Israel or the ongoing attack on Gaza. All the victims, this dehumanization, how do we resist? The war in Gaza was on the minds of many attendees, as was the war in Ukraine. A year after Navalny won the same award, Mstislav Chernov's 20 Days in Mariupol, a harrowing chronicle of the early days of Russia's invasions of Ukraine, won Best Documentary. The win, a first for the Associated Press and PBS's Frontline, came as the war in Ukraine passed the two-year mark with no signs of abating. "This is the first Oscar in Ukrainian history," said Chernov, "and I'm honored. Probably I will be the first director on this stage to say, I wish I'd never had to make this film. I wish to be able to exchange this Oscar for Russia never attacking Ukraine." In the early going, Yorgos Lanthimos's Frankenstein riff Poor Things ran away with three prizes for its sumptuous craft, including awards for production design, makeup, hairstyling, and costume design. Kimmel, hosting the ABC telecast for the fourth time, opened the awards with a monologue that drew a few cold looks. But Kimmel, emphasizing Hollywood as a union town following 2023's actor and writer strikes, drew a standing ovation for bringing out Teamsters and behind-the-scenes workers, who are now entering their own labor negotiations. The night's first award was one of its most predictable. Divine Joy Randolph for Best Supporting Actress for her performance in Alexander Payne's The Holdover. An emotional Randolph was accompanied to the stage by her Holdover's co-star, Paul Giamatti. Some people in the news. Natalie Portman and Benjamin Milpied have divorced after 11 years of marriage and two children. The Oscar-winning actor and Milpied, a choreographer and director, finalized their divorce last month in France, where they live. A representative for Portman declined comment. Representatives for Milpied did not immediately respond to requests for comment. According to People magazine, Portman, 42, filed for divorce from Milpied, 46, 8 months ago. They met on the set of 2010's Black Swan. Milpied choreographed the film, for which Portman won the Oscar for Best Actress. They wed in 2012. And a Vermont man on Friday pleaded guilty to a reduced charge of negligent driving with death, resulting in the June crash that killed actor Treat Williams. Ryan Koss, 35, who knew Williams, was given a one-year deferred sentence and as part of his probation will have his driving license revoked for a year and must complete a community restorative justice program. Cost was turning left into a parking lot in a Honda SUV on June 12th when he collided with Williams' oncoming motorcycle in Dorset. Williams, 71, who was wearing a helmet, suffered critical injuries and was airlifted to Albany Medical Center where he was pronounced dead. And that's all the time I have for today. This is your reader, Beth, saying thanks for listening and thank you for your continued support of the Audible Local Ledger.